giant of limitless power at man's command. And where was it science found that giant? In the atom, a particle so infinitely small that it takes over 100 billion atoms to make up the head of a pin.
This is Out of the Basement, a podcast dedicated to radiation medicine.
This is Dr. Jason Bechter coming at you from the wintry Vermont mountain basements. And I feel like I say this at the start of every episode, that I give some sort of warning that it's going to be strange or different. And I don't really even know why I do that, because this is clearly basically an audio journal to myself from the future to the past. And I can never tell what this looks like from the outside. But to me, it all makes sense, for whatever that's worth. And I had originally considered doing a year in review sort of episode, because that's what everyone does, right? But then I realized I both hate doing things that are considered normal, obviously, but also it was a fairly bleak year for radiation medicine in 2023 in many ways. And I shouldn't say that's not entirely true. It was a very bleak year for the legacy version of radiation medicine, the kind we've seen dominate America for the last 20 years. It was an amazing year for radiation medicine, if you define it literally any other way. I'm fairly excited for the future, but that's because I don't care that the way our field functioned in 2010 is dead and gone and never coming back. Anyone is free to join me in this optimism. All you have to do is stop thinking that change is a problem, but I'd rather do something else, something far more eccentric, because that's the word I'm going to use for myself, because it makes it sound cool, right? That's how this works. I choose to believe that's how this works. We can all probably agree that life has become very strange in a way that's hard to define. And this is true across the board, it seems, but specifically in healthcare, this all just feels different, very different. I don't care to explain that further, because you either understand what I'm saying or you don't. And if you don't, no words can make you understand. The thing that feels the strangest is progress in science and technology, though, and the communication of information and the meta communication of information. I absolutely can't believe what we can do now in terms of science and technology. And much of that is driven by the tools built by and for and with AI, but there's so much more. If you're really paying attention to the bleeding edge, it seems that we're approaching the Arthur C. Clarke version of technology, where it is indistinguishable from magic. And simultaneously, it feels like we're also approaching a Thomas Kuhn version of scientific paradigm shift, except not just in one topic, in one field, but in multiple fields, all at once. Looking around, it really makes me wonder if this was what it was like for someone born in 1880. And let me put a pin in that and tell you a story. And it's a hybrid of a story and a worldview. I assume that many of us start out in life the very same way, I would hope, I would guess, from birth to like 10 years old or so, where we think the adults in the world know what they're doing, that it's all figured out. And I know that's a pretty cliche joke now, but I'm just speaking from my own version of that. I don't think that I personally thought adults were perfect, quote unquote, just that there was an overall design and order to the world. And part of growing up is realizing that's just not true. That's part of the fun of our teenage years, the hormones and housecapes, as it were. For me, I distinctly remember a protracted existential crisis as a teenager. At least that's how I choose to interpret it now. Who knows? But because maybe I'm rewriting my own history. I really don't know. But I really struggled with discovering that adults and institutions that make mistakes aren't perfect and have no grand plan. I believe that couldn't be universally true, that there would be areas of reason and design. While there are many motivations, reasons that I got into science and medicine, a big underlying unspoken reason was that I was looking for a way to objectively study the nature of reality in a culture based on merit of ideas and respect earned by hard work. I know I was a pretty dumb kid, but I bought the culture of science propaganda hook, line, and sinker. So I rushed through undergrad in 3 years to get my beloved MD-PhD program, which was my gateway to this magical world of learned scholars I had seen on television, and I wanted to recreate the orderly world I believed in when I also believed in Santa Claus. To be clear as well, my MD-PhD program was just wonderfully amazing, and specifically Virginia Commonwealth University and the people there, my experiences there, so on. It's the this reflective complaint has nothing to do with VCU or any place I ever went to, but honestly, it's because VCU is so great that I have any shred of sanity left, and I assure you, obviously, it's just a shred. So in the very beginning of med school, as part of a microbiology lecture, I was told a story. And one thing I couldn't understand was the story at the time. This story borders on sacred to me, which is a weird thing to say, but hey, I'm a weird kid.
Barry Marshall did something in the 1980s, along with his colleague Robin Warren, that really changed the thinking as much about microorganisms and their effect on humans as the germ theory of disease itself. One of the things that Warren noted was an unusual curved bacterium that really no one had much commented on prior to that time. This was in a series of patients, it wasn't just an isolated event, and he became rather interested, but he was a pathologist. He didn't really see patients. Marshall took this list of patients that Robin Warren had developed and began to look it over. He realized that one of the patients on the list was a woman he had actually taken care of, and no one knew exactly what was wrong with her, even though she had a variety of GI symptoms, and he became quite intrigued.
That's right, we're going with this story. And just to break in here, I wonder if this story is still told in the first year or two of med school, and or maybe it probably wasn't a universal thing. I'm trying, for such a story or such an impactful story for my life, I really don't remember the details of how it was first. I think I remember that it was in a lecture, and so it could have just been an off-the-cuff sort of thing that was not an official part of the curriculum. So maybe it just happened in VCU in 2008, 2009 when this story was told, but in a micro course. I can't believe that's true, but whatever. And the other thing too, it's interesting, I'm going with this Italian accent AI because it is very interesting to experiment with the AI voice narrators and to see the limitations of each. Obviously, on the back end of these things, there's a lot of work that goes into this and a lot of experimentation. And it's very interesting that the platform I use, this Italian accent really helps the AI out. So sometimes when you pick other ones like American accents or even the British ones, sometimes about midway through, they start to pronounce words incorrectly. And I'm sure it's some very interesting sort of mechanistic problem within the coding. But that's why you hear me switch around. This is a completely derailed side note, but it's just so interesting to see what the AI can handle. But back to the story.
So what they eventually did was put together all of the patients that had issues, and they decided to do a study of 100 patients. They found that every single patient that had a duodenal ulcer had evidence of this bacterium, which we now know is H. pylori. In 1983, Barry Marshall decides he's going to present this association between H. pylori and peptic ulcer disease at the Royal Australian College of Physicians meeting in Perth, Australia. When asked how it went, Marshall said, "I did the presentation and the gastroenterologists didn't believe a bit of it. Someone sort of stood up and said, 'Barry, you know, people with duodenal ulcers don't have gastritis, but I had done so much literature searching, I knew that they were wrong. So it was difficult to tell your senior bosses trained at the Mayo Clinic that they were wrong.'"
This was the start of the part where the story confused young Jason Bechta, because it didn't make any sense that the senior physicians and scientists disagreed with this guy. That was confusing because he had all the data. It was pretty clear, at least, you know, in this sanitized version of the story, but obviously it was H. pylori. And I remember being confused at this part of the story of like, what is happening here? Where is this going?
Right at the end of the day before going home, Marshall went up to the micro lab and, with the lab tech there, opened the incubator and got that Petri dish out. And there was this crisp zone around the bismuth disc, and he knew that if you drink Pepto-Bismol, that's pretty effective. When you have a putative organism that causes a disease, one of the ways to prove that this organism causes this disease is to prove Koch's postulates. The problem was they could not develop an animal model for H. pylori. He tried many different ways, many different animals, with any number of different types of inoculums, and he could not develop one. He was quite frustrated and doing this, and so, with that frustration, he took really quite a brave step. He mixed up a slurry of H. pylori bacteria and drank it, knowing that he had a normal biopsy of his stomach before he did this. And then 10 days later, he got the same endoscopist to do a biopsy. And as he said, he had bacteria everywhere. He had done the self-experimentation. Marshall said, "I went home and told my wife about it." And of course, she was like, "Oh my God, you're gonna infect the whole family. That's why you've got such a bad breath. This is disaster." He was surprised that he got this acute illness, but it helped him develop the natural history of what happens when someone gets H. pylori. Often, particularly in developing world, very young children will get this acute illness with some vomiting, and then things will die down for a while. Marshall was very sick, but he was able to treat and cure himself.
And then this story ends with Marshall winning the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 2005. So, though I hope it doesn't need to be spelled out like this, the question is, why would this story stick with me? Because I thought this story was insane. I could not conceive at the time how or why this would or could happen. Marshall's discovery of the link between H. pylori and ulcers was an almost scripted version of what Bill Nye told me science was. And they didn't believe him. They didn't believe Marshall. And he drank the bacteria to make himself sick because otherwise people wouldn't believe him. He underwent 2 endoscopies with biopsies? What? I've never gotten over this. For the last, I genuinely don't know, 15 or 16 years, I think about this story at least once a month. I don't want to be hyperbolic again, but sometimes it's more than that. We'll put it like that. And I think it's a version of PTSD. The fact that I still think about this because this story marks the beginning of, and I don't, again, know how to say this without kind of sounding dramatic. I guess it marks the beginning of the worldview that informs my current personality. And obviously, I could phrase that very dramatically, but I'm just going to end there. This podcast might be my audio journal, but it's not a Elizabethan-style dramatic play, so I'm just going to calm down on that one. But so to give you the point of this story is, and to give context to my perception of science. And this is the best example I know of scientific paradigms and paradigm shifts. And once you see this pattern, you can't stop seeing it. It's everywhere. And I literally mean everywhere. And Thomas Kuhn's book on paradigm shifts was published in 1963. And so that this pattern was old then. Like you don't just bust out the book. Like he had been observing and thinking about this for quite some time. So in all of our modern definition of science, just it's versions of this story. And that's the core reason why I'm so vocal about low-dose radiotherapy for benign conditions. And I don't quite remember when I first discovered specifically, my favorite is obviously the low-dose radiation for osteoarthritis. And I don't remember when I found that the first time. I think it was actually during my PhD, so quite some time ago. But it didn't stand out to me then because I wasn't so deep in the lore and culture of the clinical side of radiation medicine. Back then, I didn't have a context to understand all the weird politics. And it came back on my radar, the LDRT, probably about 2017 or 2018, which by then I was in really deep into the jungle of the specialties, culture, and politics. And I remember reading it somewhere, thinking, what the hell is this? And jumping on Google Scholar. And then again, as I usually am, I was confused, either implicitly or explicitly in American medicine. At the time, this was considered a hoax. That might be too strong. Pseudoscience, snake oil. But plain as day, from other parts of the world, there was a mountain of data and evidence supporting the practice of LDRT, both in vivo, mechanistically, and clinically with outcomes. And LDRT for arthritis is just another version of Marshall and his bacterial ulcers. I would argue it's worse in some ways, because at least Marshall was like one guy. Well, technically, it was Marshall and Warren, so it was two people. The evidence for LDRT actually dates back literally 100 years, literally a century. It's from all over the planet and has both bench and bedside components. I'll digress. That's not the point of this episode. So there are two parts to the ulcer archetype, which some losers may call scientific paradigm shift. First, you have to have clear, overwhelming evidence that something we thought we knew was wrong. And the second part is chugging bacteria to make your stomach bleed. which, you know, is just not practical. To zoom out on it, a paradigm shift requires a diehard champion or group of diehard champions. For an idea to survive, when that idea challenges an existing paradigm, it requires people to willingly endure the scorn of their colleagues for an undetermined amount of time. That is very hard to do for most people, and that's why most people don't do it. So these are the primary pillars of kind of how I view and act in the world. One is that when I was a kid, I thought I could become a scientist, and that was where I could live a life of merit and objectivity. Science and the industrial science complex loves subjectivity, ego, pedigree, and politicking. So I was totally wrong. That's pillar one. Pillar two is it wasn't until I had already committed to this path that I truly came to understand that any ideas or evidence which do not fit into the existing paradigm are bitterly and painfully fought. And anything new requires a champion or champions willing to endure this insane crucible if it's going to survive. And that's the foundation, or at least part of the foundation, for what I mean by frame 122, which is likely still in the title of this episode. Who knows? I might change it again, but whatever. Frame 122. And specifically, what frame 122 is, the 122 years in between Rentgen's discovery of X-rays and Google publishing on transformer models. In my opinion, why I picked those dates is because it appears to me that we as humans think of reality, at least as it pertains to science and technology, but honestly also culture, religion, politics to at least some degree. All of what we think of as reality is based on events and discoveries and paradigms within those 122 years. So before 1895, there was this whole invisible world that we didn't know existed. And obviously, I find everything about the invisible world of radiation that can affect physical reality fascinating enough to devote my whole life to it, get a PhD in molecular radiobiology and get board certification in one of the radiation-based specialties, because I think it's fantastical and magical. And on a grander scale, it represents a turning point for us where radiation and radioactivity has obviously always existed, but up until 1895, it was unknown to us. I think that's profound for many reasons on a philosophical level, but also I think 1895 is important just simply due to the fact that radioactivity underpins basically all of modern medicine in many ways, even if not directly, it's indirectly. And so that is a clear start point. And discovering of X-rays sets us up on this whole path of where we are today. And then transformer models are the endpoint of this frame of reality. So in 2017, Google published this model, the transformer models. And what that is a neural network that learns context and therefore meaning by tracking relationships in sequential data, like words in a sentence, like words in this sentence. And transformer models apply a set of mathematical techniques, which are always devolving, that are called attention or self-attention, to detect subtle ways that even distant data elements in a series influence and depend on each other. And this is basically one of the most powerful things ever invented. And it's a driving force between what we're seeing in AI right now and the advancement of AI. And you have, starting in at least 2021, people calling them foundational models. And it's what underpins things like ChatGPT. So AI, deep learning, machine learning has been around for longer than I think many people realize. But when it starts to kind of creep in and be very clear with things like ChatGPT, that's possible because of transformer models. And, you know, if anyone who's spent 5 minutes looking at what AI can do right now realizes why I would mark that development as the end of a certain frame. So that's what frame 122 is, paradigm 122. It's 122 years in between X-rays to transformer models. And so returning to paradigm shifts and my horror, existential horror over the Barry Marshall H. pylori story, what is Kuhn's hypothesis? And obviously, I think he's correct, and I rarely say that about anything in science, but the assumption is for a paradigm shift that change happens, shifts happen by trickles of questions and then a flood of changes. And so because the world is vast and humans are limited, despite what many of us want to believe otherwise, research has to stay within a certain subset of beliefs most of the time for heuristics, basically. Our brains would explode or melt. So we rely on these broad assumptions about the world and whatever field we're working in to just survive, do our work. And that's normal science. And then as time progresses, we just discover more and more things, more data that presents paradoxes or directly contradicts the dominant paradigm. And these contradictions build and build until we have theories that are posited to make sense of them by basically proposing an entirely new assumption, belief of the world, and it sweeps away the previous paradigm, replacing it with a new one. The very sanitized version of what happens, as we all know, because it's usually quite insanely painful, where there's just people that are like ripping apart their careers and lives because they believe that the data shows one thing and everyone else says no. And then finally it's like, oh yes, it is self-evident. Of course we need that. And, you know, the H. pylori thing is just kind of a modern example, but this is what happened with evolution, with germs themselves. People didn't believe in germs. With the orbit of the sun, you know, and so if I like the H. pylori story because it shows, we like to talk about and think about these things like, it's just those stupid humans in the past. No, we do it constantly. We're still doing it now. We will continue to do it. It's just how we exist. And it drives me nuts. But when I was studying for the physics board for radiation oncology, I found, obviously I'd heard about it before, but I didn't truly understand it until I was studying for boards, I think. Again, another thing I don't quite remember where this first came across my mind, but the concept of IMRT, inverse planning, and local versus global minima and maxima. And so IMRT, or intensity modulated radiation therapy, is the thing that was invented 20 years ago that really threw everybody for a loop for multiple good and bad reasons. But so the important step in IMRT is inverse planning, and within that, optimization. And optimization is the process by which the optimum intensity profile of each beam is determined. And it's the goodness of a solution is measured usually by an objective function, which is like dose or dose volume based, you know, whatever. There are two types of search algorithms. There's probably more, but again, this isn't my real world, so don't crucify me if you actually know all the different IMRT algorithms, you weirdo. So the two main ones are stochastic or random and deterministic. And the stochastic methods, in principle, can find a global solution, whereas the deterministic methods may get trapped in a local solution. And then in practice, in reality, it is difficult to determine whether a solution you're looking at on the screen is a global or a local one, regardless of which methods you use, because it's entirely possible that a stochastic method would just find a local solution and a deterministic method would find a global solution. We just don't know. This is life. Like that, I just couldn't get over this, because this is describing paradigms and paradigm shifts and how humans view reality, where logically, and it makes sense, where evolutionarily, the deterministic methods, the reason paradigms exist in the first place is it's how our real, tangible reality works, because usually in our real lives and things that aren't abstract probing of the universe, things build on each other. And, you know, if you have a trash can that you put garbage in, then the garbage is not going to magically be full in 1 second to the next, or it's not going to magically empty itself in 1 second to the next. There's going to be a buildup of trash within the trash can until it is full, and then you hopefully decide to do something about it, to take care of it. That is the process that 99% of our regular lives works, this deterministic building on previous steps. And so therefore we are, I would argue, hardwired basically to view that everything through that lens. That's wrong. And so it's crazy to me that this is just all around us. We see it all the time. Many people much smarter than I have talked about this and written beautiful books and theories and whatever, and we just still fall for the same trap over and over and over. It's ridiculous. So I'm going to yank the wheel real hard here, and there's a very specific reason that I am coming to this point 20-something minutes in, and it is not in the title or the description, and I will certainly not be advertising this for a very specific reason. And you'll see why in a minute. So this is Francis Collins, who up until last year was the director of the NIH, the head of the NIH. He was in that position since I think 2009 or so. And he is speaking this summer, so July of 2023, with an institution and organization called Braver Angels, which is just about, as far as I can figure, a organization that is tired of people yelling at each other, which obviously I think is a great plan. But take it away, Francis.
As you heard, I had the privilege of serving under three presidents, Obama, Trump, and Biden, as the director of the NIH. And that meant, of course, that I was the NIH director in January of 2020 when the COVID pandemic began to appear in a way that was ultimately the greatest pandemic threat to the world in more than 100 years. And so it was my job to try to see what we could do to coordinate all of the science that would be necessary to address this. And that meant coming up with a strategy that could develop vaccines faster than has ever happened before, coming up with a way of evaluating whether there were treatments that might work, even things that we already knew about, but also designing new ones, developing monoclonal antibodies. I was not in a position of having a lot to say about the public health measures, but I was certainly in that group that met in the West Wing of the White House to try to decide what to recommend at a time where people were dying around us. I mean, turn the clock back to March or April of 2020, when this really began to hit very hard, particularly in big cities like New York. And at that time, we had no effective way to fight back against this. So I and my colleagues in both the government, the academic environment, the private sector, pulled together the kind of partnerships that we've never done before and didn't worry too much about who's going to get the credit and made the lawyers stay out of the room because I'm sure they would have objected to having these people all work together and tried to see what we could do as rapidly as possible to come up with a strategy that might save lives. And a big part of that was the vaccine effort. And you've heard about that mRNA approach, which had been under development for 25 years, but had never actually been carried all the way through to an FDA-approved vaccine. And it was a high risk to do that. But we knew that if that was possible, it would be quicker. I was totally immersed in that. I was working 100 hours a week for most of 2020. And when that trial was conducted, both the Pfizer trial, the Moderna trial, we all were holding our breath that maybe we might have something here that would protect people because throughout 2020, we really didn't have much. And there was that night in late November of 2020 when the results of the trials were unblinded. The way this is done is you ask volunteers, God bless them, to sign up and say, I'll be part of this trial. And they don't know if they're getting the vaccine or they're getting a dummy shot. 30,000 of them. And they don't know what they got. And the people who gave a shot didn't know what it was. It's all coded.
So where am I going with this? And I have aggressively avoided this topic, both personally and professionally, which might actually be a tremendous sin on my part. But to back way up as to how I got to this point and why this is now in this episode. So I have become very interested, or maybe I've always been interested. So in the concept of paradigm shifts, bias is usually what causes these paradigms or the resistance to change. And I think obviously much of my content, whether in official publications or social media or this podcast, has been about professional societies and radiation medicine and job market and all those things. And my main thesis is always just the data is there and it runs counter to the narrative that people had believed or want to believe. And it's just a classic sort of example of paradigm shift. And as some of you have seen, if you follow me on X, formerly Twitter, I've posted some things on UAPs or what is now the official branding of UFOs. Unidentified anomalous phenomena. And for those who aren't aware, which I'm surprised to learn that actually people didn't know this. So in 2017, there was a very large article published in the New York Times with leaked videos from the Navy, and there's the United States government had denied for decades that they didn't study UFOs after Project Blue Book ended. And oh, wait, no, that was a lie. They actually do. And so then since 2017, so now we're on coming into year 7 of a lot of this stuff coming out. And I had ignored that topic as well. This might be my greatest personal failing. So to me, this topic was taboo as a classically trained traditional scientist. I was supposed to ignore it. And I did very well ignore this topic. And so finally, even I was aware of the 2017 article. And even until probably 2022 was when I was successful in ignoring it. And then once I actually looked at it, It was quite surprising. That's not what this episode is going to be about. But in that world, in that topic of unidentified stuff, there is the concept of mis and disinformation, which has just really permeated everything. And that's actually where Frame 122 also comes from, is that if you, any of us who exist in the world who are conscious and read things, we are bombarded by these buzzwords and these topics, and it has just become so difficult to figure out what is true, what the agendas are, and it all ties together. And so I have been spending a lot of time over the last year of exploring the concept of information agents, information actors, how propaganda is created, and what is propaganda. It's actually fascinating. And I kind of, you know, if I could live 100 lives, I would be a social psychologist and do that as well. But because I'm searching for a set of tools, which don't really, it doesn't really exist. This is like a pie in the sky sort of thing on my part, but I'm still going to try. So what I want is a set of tools, is a way for me to approach the world, knowing that there are competing interest factions, organizations, interest out there that want to influence everything I do. This is true for all of us. Every bit of our lives is somebody is trying to get something from us. And conversely, we are trying to get something from somebody else. That is the essence of life, whether or not you want to pretend like it isn't. It is. And this has led me down to kind of how do the information agencies, the three-letter agencies, the intelligence community, how do they deal with this? Because they are often blamed for creating misinformation or disinformation, but they also have to deal with it themselves. And this is just super fascinating, and there's 100 episodes in this. But the CIA published in 2009, let me take that back. I read a lot of Freedom of Information Act request stuff, which is, again, if you guys aren't using that, it's the greatest tool ever invented. But so I can't remember if this was published or if this was acquired through FOIA, but there's something called the Tradecraft Primer. And it is a way for intelligence analysts on how to formally approach information or how to formalize the systems of information. And I find this whole taxonomy or this whole system just incredibly useful for my own life. A aphorism, I guess, whatever you want to call it, that I am incredibly fond of saying, is that we judge others by their actions and ourselves by our intentions. And it is in that spirit that I am so incredibly fascinated with Francis Collins in this talk, which is just, as of this recording, has less than 5,000 views on YouTube, which is a travesty. So let's listen to a little bit more of Francis, and then we will return to how the human brain processes information.
And the people overseeing it don't know until you get to the point of unblinding the data. And that's what happened that night. And I had thought if we had a vaccine that maybe was 50% effective, that would be pretty amazing because vaccines usually fail. And yet it was unblinded. And the result for both Pfizer and Moderna was efficacy 95%. I had prayed about that. I'm a person of faith. And I will unashamedly tell you, I cried like a baby that night because it seemed like the prayers were answered and we had something now that was going to be able to protect against the terrible devastation that we were seeing. And I felt pretty optimistic. Like, okay, we're on a path here. And through the first part of 2021, I felt pretty optimistic. But then by the time we got to the point where anybody who could get a vaccine had access to it easily and cheaply, in fact, it was free, it was pretty clear that we had lost some important discussion along the way. And 50 million Americans said, no, thank you. I couldn't figure out what happened. But there were so many other messages coming at people that good, honorable, wonderful people I knew were suspicious, were uncomfortable, they'd heard things. It's a hard thing to tell you, but the people who have looked at the consequences of that would tell you there are more than 200,000 people in graveyards in this country who didn't need to be because of this fear that the vaccine might be harmful. When in fact, again, I'm the scientist here and we'll be glad to go into the details of why I say it with such confidence. I do believe there's such a thing as truth. The vaccine actually, while it had rare side effects, let's not put that aside. For the most part, this was a lifesaver. probably saved about 2 million lives in the United States. So we got to that point, and I'm going to stop here in a second and get to masks. I just wonder what happened.
Obviously, when I edit these podcasts and things, I use a lot of audio enhancements and equalizers and so on and so forth. But even through the sound enhancements, I think it's, you can hear how emotional he is and he means it. And I think that's a problem, actually. So it's both the most important thing for someone in any sort of position of authority, as he is, as I am. Obviously, he's in a little bit of a different position, but that emotion, that caring is both what it means to be human, but also a problem in science, and which might ruffle feathers to say, but returning to sort of my desperate questing for a set of tools to evaluate information in this brave new world. After kind of going down this path of the tradecraft primer and how do people in the intelligence community deal with information and mis- and disinformation. And so there's a paper that, so the tradecraft primer was 2009. And then there's a paper that came out in the following years that is a taxonomy, a structured analytical techniques taxonomy. Because just like anything else, there's these tools, and then people are like, whoa, wait, you know, you're telling us to use these tools, but you, do they work? Like, do they matter? So just again, bias, paradigms, so on and so forth. But I won't kind of go into all the details about it. You can, I'll have a sources link. But so in this taxonomy of structured analytical techniques, you have describing techniques, explaining techniques, evaluating techniques, and estimating techniques. And in those four broad categories. So describing is exactly what it is. So when you have new information, just it's simply descriptive methods to say, this is what information I am looking at and sorting it. And those are things like chronologies and sorting and matrices and starbursting and so on and so forth. So then in the explaining techniques, that's your hypothesis generation. One of the structured analytical techniques is structured analogies, you know, using this new information in a system, an analogous system, something that you understand, or if you put it in another way of saying it, would it help you explore the information differently? Most importantly, though, is in the evaluating techniques, at least most important for me. There are two key things that I found very helpful for myself. One is the technique of key assumptions check, and two is the structured self-critique. And after really kind of finding this and thinking about this and applying this, I realized that most of my own problems, and I don't even know if problems are like a right way to do it, but most of my own biases or flaws in how I have personally evaluated information drive from these two things. From I'm walking into a situation with key assumption, and I'm not stepping back and saying, you know, this is what I'm thinking right now. Is that reasonable? The structured self-critique. Let's listen to some more of Francis and Francis's experience of the pandemic.
I was naive. I thought, you know, if we had science and we had facts, everybody would come to a common agreement about what to do with that information. And clearly, that was not the way it turned out. I had to recognize that we are not rational actors. I'm not either. That we have other sources of information. We don't agree about whether my truth is your truth. And we have a serious challenge to our future if we don't begin to understand how that has divided us. This should have been the moment where we came together with a common enemy in mind, the virus. And instead, we ended up oftentimes with different ideas about who the enemies were. And politics got in there in an incredibly malignant way, I'll have to say. So I, at the end of that very painful experience, reached out to my friend David Brooks and said, what are you doing about this? And he told me about Braver Angels. And that's how I ended up, more than a year ago, joining up with this Truth and Trust project.
I think this is just absolutely remarkable. And I think the world would be a much better place if anyone in any sort of position of authority who has to make difficult decisions could do this, where I think, again, just going back to, we judge ourselves by our intentions and others by their actions. And I think what you can just hear in his voice, all he wants to do is the right thing, be a force for good in the world. And I think I talk about this a lot in my regular context of professional societies and radiation medicine and choices that were made. And I, going back a couple episodes of emergent properties of complex systems, and that it is so rare to have evil people, however you want to define that, or no one is the villain in their own story, but it's so rare to have people who are actively trying to do bad things. And certainly they exist, and you've met them, I've met them, but it is not the norm. If faced with a choice, like, yeah, we're usually selfish to a degree, but no one is really actively out to get anyone in general. I mean, again, yes, it happens, but it's not the majority. And I'll touch on conspiracy in a second here and what that means, but there is often not sort of I could be totally wrong about this, but there's not some secretive, overarching plan, goal, cabal, whatever word you want to use to do certain things. There are certainly people with influence who conspire. Like conspiracy is it's a legal term, as we actually has shown up in many prior episodes. Like it's lots and lots and lots of people and institutions and organizations get charged with conspiracy every year in this country. It's quite common, actually. But the problem with Francis, this actually really changed. I don't want to say flipped, because I still have my reservations about Francis Collins. So for people who are not in this world, when Francis Collins was named director of the NIH by Obama, many of us were not happy. And I would count myself among those people. So Francis Collins was famous for mapping the human genome. And what Francis Collins is also notable for is being an evangelical Christian. And in 2006, he wrote a book called The Language of God, A Scientist Presents Evidence for Belief. And a large part of my PhD dissertation project was human embryonic stem cells. And you can imagine how challenging it was to do that when there was a lot of legacy Supreme Court issues and whatnot. And then we have Francis Collins coming in. And so I just to touch on using these structured analytical techniques and evaluating what Francis is saying here about how his confusion, his work, his effort, his belief about the vaccine. So I remember this time vividly, as I assume literally every person who is listening to this right now. I mean, unless you're a 10-year-old and you somehow stumbled upon this podcast and made it this far in, which is bizarre. I obviously remember this year vividly. And I was also just like, I mean, I was watching it from afar. I was not in Francis's position, but I was rooting aggressively for this. And thinking about some of these structured analytical techniques, so specifically analogies, structured analogies, key assumption check, and self-critique. And going through just this monologue from him, the analogies I have is thinking about radiation oncology, radiation medicine, radiation oncology. When did Pfizer become the good guy? When did that happen? So in literally every other aspect, all big pharma is used as a pejorative, except in this one thing, in this one time. And I also suspended disbelief on that one and was rooting for Pfizer. It's an interesting thing for me to say, in Moderna. And not, we don't do that otherwise. Like we somehow, the cognitive dissonance in that fact is disappeared. And so going through the night of the unblinding, as he tells it in the story, the analogy I would have for is the difference between progression-free survival and overall survival, and what endpoints matter. And so when he says 95% effective, the vaccine development had started in 2020. The vaccine unblinding ended in 2020, November. And as I recall, something like 63 days, I think, was when the phase one clinical trial started for these vaccines. So we're talking about 95% effective for a vaccine that had been out for less than a year. And would we accept this in any of our trials? I think the closer would be when we talk about things like prostate or breast, different schemes. So I think about like the FAST and the FAST forward trials with breast. Everyone was just clamoring for 5-year and 10-year data. No one would really want to accept these results until we had long-term data. What happened here? I don't remember saying that. I certainly didn't. Again, I was also one of the ones that just somehow didn't have a problem with this. And the thing with how he tells the story here about biases and assumptions is he says he couldn't figure out what happened when there were so many, quote unquote, other messages coming at people from the good, honorable, wonderful people that he knows were suspicious, uncomfortable, they heard things. So clearly he is all in on this effort, this vaccine, and he doesn't get it, why anyone would question it. And then he says, because of this fear that the vaccine might be harmful, when in fact, again, I'm the scientist here and we'll be glad to go into the detail of why I say it with such confidence. I do believe that there's such a thing in truth. The vaccine actually, while it had rare side effects, let's not put that aside, for the most part was a lifesaver. And I'm not questioning that, of course, but the key part with Francis Collins is what he says right here. I do believe there's such a thing as truth. So first of all, science is not, that's not what science is. Science is a series of methods and perspectives and approaches on the study of the natural world to get us closer to the truth. Science does not tell you the truth. That's why it's called the theory of evolution, right? It's not the fact of evolution. That's not what science is. And it makes me extraordinarily uncomfortable to see this sentence. And then I'm reminded of his book and the fact that one of the problems that people had when Francis Collins was named the director of the NIH was his organization that he founded named BioLogos, which he still is involved with today. You can go look it up on YouTube. So in this context of scientific truth, here's a passage from his book. In that context, I find theistic evolution or BioLogos to be by far the most scientifically consistent and spiritually satisfying of the alternatives. This position will not go out of style or be disproven by future scientific discoveries. It is intellectually rigorous. It provides answers to many otherwise puzzling questions, and it allows science and faith to fortify each other like two unshakable pillars holding up a building called truth. So Francis's version of truth is not my version of truth. I don't recall this version of truth being ever presented to me in my scientific education and experience, where he is literally saying his version, his theistic evolution theory, is perfect, is literally set in stone from on high. And so I am very uncomfortable to hear this. Again, I am also incredibly, I respect this tremendously. This is such a weird thing for me to see, because the fact, while I disagree with this vehemently, the fact that he's doing it and saying it, I find tremendously impressive, and I respect the hell out of it. I don't even know what to say about this, because this, you just don't see this anymore. But he says this incredibly problematic sentence of whether my truth is your truth, and we have a serious challenge to our future if we don't begin to understand how that has divided us. He's using a talking point of truth in that, and I'm not going to delve into that because I don't respect it. These talking points that are just permeated. And so he's right. So what Francis Collins is saying there is he's using a post-pandemic media talking point of debating truth. I would flip it around and go back to 2006 Francis Collins and truth. I strongly agree here that my truth is not 2006 Francis Collins's truth, because his truth is permanent from God, and that is his version of science. And this is sort of another thing we need to consider when we evaluate this, because, and this is kind of the point of this episode, is that this is my sin again, was ignoring this because I didn't want to deal with it. I don't want to do this episode. I really don't. And I really stalled. Can't even tell you how long this has taken me to do. I just don't want to do it, but that's not who I want to be, right? And it is my responsibility, and I would argue it's all of our responsibilities, to actually engage with these things. We are physicians, you know, for me, responsible for a huge portion of this community here in Vermont, and I by myself have to make an awful lot of choices for the health of this community. And what does it really say about me if I'm going to willfully ignore an aspect of health because it is uncomfortable. That's not who I want to be. And let's continue on with more of what Francis has to say. Because again, as much as I don't like a lot of the stuff Francis says, I just can't get over how wonderful it is of him to do this.
So back to your question about masking. This is a mess. I just wanted to say one little chapter that happened, and then I will come to the point about what I got wrong, because there's plenty of it. You know, early on, when the COVID pandemic was just starting, we did not really know how this virus was transmitted. It was a coronavirus. The other coronaviruses we knew about, that SARS and MERS, got transmitted. That's why they were so serious, but only by people who were really sick. SARS-CoV-2, the COVID-19 virus, fooled us and turned out to be very capable of being transmitted by people who had no symptoms. That's still true today. So the idea that people should walk around wearing masks early on didn't seem to be necessary. If you're feeling fine, you're probably not infectious. Wrong, but we didn't know it was wrong. There was also an argument about, well, masks are in shortage and we should save them for the people in the hospitals. And that was sort of an argument too. And then we found out we were completely wrong about that. And the opportunity here to turn this into a lesson about science, where you think you have the data, but then the data changes and then you realize, oh, I have to change my conclusion. We totally blew it on that. And instead, what you suddenly heard was, oh, everybody should put on a mask. And I don't blame anybody when they heard that of saying, these guys don't know what the hell they're talking about. They told me this 2 months ago, and now they're telling me that. I don't trust that they really have a clue. And maybe they're actually trying to manipulate me. So what we did wrong, what I did wrong, because I had plenty of these moments in television interviews, is we failed to say, every time there was a recommendation, guys, this is the best we can do right now. There's a good chance this is wrong. We didn't say that. We wanted to be sure people actually motivated themselves by what we said, because we wanted change to happen in case it was right. But we did not admit our ignorance. And that was a profound mistake. And we lost a lot of credibility along the way. And that one, I will not forget.
I had like an out-of-body experience when I heard that the first time, because one, that should just be the speaking tour, because he is correct. That is what they should have done. And it could go a long way to repairing things. And that's, I say that a lot on this podcast and in real life and on X, and that I don't respect people who don't say I'm wrong. And the two most important things to say, whether you're a doctor, scientist, or just a human being, is I made a mistake and I was wrong. Those things, because it shows you're human. Like, if you're not making mistakes, you're not trying. Really, the only people who don't make mistakes are the ones who aren't doing anything, and or liars. So, but how I use this now, why I had an out-of-body experience, was that this is what I say in consults to all of my patients. And what I mean by that is they often will come in so confused because they've heard a million things. They're not in the healthcare. They're not in medicine. They don't understand the words that we use, and they're so confused. And when you kind of walk through that with them, kind of what has been said before, what the plan is moving forward, I will explain it like this, where I will say, look, this is what medicine is, where medicine, you think medicine is black and white, and it is not. And do you remember how the recommendations about masks change? And, you know, usually that's the debate that happens behind the scenes in tumor board, except in COVID, you had to, you saw it in public. And I use this as my example for how medicine is. And I wish that they could have said that back then, and they still can. They could go on a speaking tour. This can be said a lot. But I use this exact thing to explain the ambiguous nature, the gray sea adrift of confusion that is medicine. And we don't tell people about that. And so they think that we can just snap our fingers and it's a yes or a no, and it's not. That's not it. Just say this. And so now we're going to move into why I didn't want to do this episode, why I have never talked about this ever, meaning there's just anything about the pandemic, and it's this specific thing coming up. So you're going to hear a guy named Will Wilkinson. He's the other, there was a couple of people on stage for this. So he sets this up by talking about the conversation, and I'll let it go from here.
So when I think about, you know, don't make mandates, make better arguments, don't shut down the conversation, have the conversation, win on the battlefield of ideas, do it in a civil way, but do it in the intellectual, good-natured way that we would do at Braver Angels. What say you?
I'm glad to talk about this and appreciate the chance to explain a little bit about the context, because I don't know that's gotten clearly explained. So this was October of 2020. We had no vaccines. People were dying at high rates at that point across the country, but particularly in cities. There was a hope we might have a vaccine in another couple of months, but nobody knew if it was going to work. These three epidemiologists, very distinguished by their credentials, were convened in a gathering in Massachusetts by Scott Atlas, who was at that time advising the president. And they put together this short declaration, which said, let's stop with the closures of businesses and schools. Most people who are under 60 or 65, if they get the virus, they're going to survive. Let's not try to protect them. Let's try to protect those who are vulnerable, the elderly, and maybe some others who are compromised. And eventually, the virus will run its course through the healthier people, and we will be able to get through this without so much damage done to daily life. It was sort of a letter rip as far as the younger people. Maybe it's not a great phrase, but it was different than what was currently being proposed. Different. That declaration would have been a great opportunity for a broad scientific discussion about the pros and cons, but that's not how it was presented. On the day it was presented to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, it would have been presented the next day to the president if he wasn't in Walter Reed at the time being treated for COVID. This was an effort to take a very fast track of something which would have potentially been a major change in national policy without the opportunity. As somebody who is deeply engaged in the federal effort to try to save lives, I saw this and I was deeply troubled. I regret that I used some terminology that I probably shouldn't, that somebody should put forward a devastating takedown of the dangers here, and I regret that. But I was deeply worried. In a few days, no less than 14 of the public health or associations of the United States all together wrote a scathing takedown of the Great Barrington Declaration, saying this would probably kill tens of thousands of people. And so ultimately, that was the scientific discussion. But the effort was made by the authors and some help from Dr. Atlas to try to short circuit all that and get that into a policy decision without the opportunity for debate. So I don't regret saying this is dangerous. It was.
We judge ourselves by our intentions and others by their actions. And in case you, like me, needed a refresher of what the Great Barrington Declaration was, here is an excerpt from a Wall Street Journal article.
The tale unfolded in October 2020 after the launch of the Great Barrington Declaration. A statement by Harvard's Martin Kulldorff, Oxford's Sunetra Gupta, and Stanford's Jay Bhattacharya against blanket pandemic lockdowns. They favored a policy of what they called focused protection of high-risk populations, such as the elderly or those with medical conditions. Thousands of scientists signed the declaration if they were able to learn about it. We tried to give it some elevation on these pages of the Wall Street Journal. That didn't please the lockdown consensus enforced by public health officials and the press. Dr. Collins, the director of the National Institutes of Health, sent an email on October 8, 2020, to Dr. Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. This proposal from the three fringe epidemiologists seems to be getting a lot of attention and even a co-signature from Nobel Prize winner Mike Leavitt at Stanford. There needs to be a quick and devastating published takedown of its premises, Dr. Collins wrote. Is it underway? These researchers weren't fringe and neither was their opposition to quarantining society. But in the panic over the virus, these two voices of science used their authority to stigmatize dissenters and crush debate. A week after his email, Dr. Collins spoke to the Washington Post about the Great Barrington Declaration. This is a fringe component of epidemiology, he said. This is not mainstream science. It's dangerous. His message spread, and the alternative strategy was dismissed in most precincts. Dr. Fauci replied to Dr. Collins that the takedown was underway, an article in Wired, a tech news site, denied there was any scientific divide and argued lockdowns were a straw man, they weren't coming back, if only it were true. The next month, cases rose and restrictions returned. On CBS last month, Dr. Fauci said Republicans who criticize him are really criticizing science because I represent science. That's dangerous.
So in graduate school, I had, there's a handful of people on my dissertation committee who I love to pieces, but there were two in particular. And one of the professors who was on my dissertation committee, I thought, and still think that he's just one of the smartest human beings to ever walk the planet. And when he was moving labs, this was, I think, a year before I came to VCU, he was there on the weekend trying to move all of his stuff from one lab to his new bigger lab. And he had a giant bucket of, it's not really a bucket, but like a 5-gallon drum of sulfuric acid, because we use sulfuric acid a lot for certain experiments. And he, this was Virginia in the summer, he was in shorts and sandals, which is against laboratory safety protocol, but you know, it's Virginia in the summer. And he either tripped and or something, I can't remember, but he spilled the sulfuric acid on his legs in the shorts. And he then spent a very long time in the hospital recovering, because just pro tip, don't spill sulfuric acid on your legs, especially not a couple gallons of it. And again, this is one of the smartest human beings I know and someone I respect tremendously. And so when the pandemic started and I heard that there was a certain institute that was at the epicenter of where all this started, I thought, yeah, you know, it seems like could easily be an accident. I've seen them happen all the time. And I think I even said that once or twice out loud, but, and then I learned that I wasn't supposed to say that was racist. And so I thought, oh, that's interesting. Well, I guess, okay. And then this happened and I had forgotten about this because again, I try to actively ignore all this, but I remember being really confused by this because even though I wasn't ignoring it as actively as I have been afterwards, I was still at least seeing what was happening. And I didn't understand why, you know, people who seemed like they were reasonable had at least floated this declaration thing. And then the just brutal response from Collins and everyone else. And I learned a lesson that I better not say anything, that I better just ignore it. That's actually this event. And I part of why I'm doing this is I assume I'm not alone in that. I assume actually most people are probably like me, because there's actually not a lot of people who engage in this, especially right now, but even throughout it was just kind of, you know, loud people throughout, but a lot of us didn't touch any of this. And this scared the shit out of me. Like, I wanted nothing to do with this, because this isn't science. This isn't how this goes. And like, yeah, we were all scared. And this was a hopefully once in a lifetime event, but there's no excuse for this. And what's even more interesting, and I'm not going to, this isn't getting into details about, it's not what this episode's about. It's about exploring biases and examining yourself. And, you know, it's awfully interesting when Francis Collins in 2017 lifted the ban on gain of function research and how, yeah, there was definitely NIH funding that went to a certain institute in a certain place in China, and they certainly lied about it. And if you guys don't know what I'm talking about, it's pretty easy to find. I mean, you have to Google it because it's not widely covered like other things are, but you know, all the stuff is plain as day. It's all official. And that's kind of where this all got started for me too, was two things. One, I just, you know, obviously I kind of exist in a bubble where I stopped paying attention to news and politics, and you guys can all go check all of my stuff that's out there. I don't talk about this stuff, and it's by design. I think probably about 2012, I decided I was done with all this, and I just kind of stayed in my radiation medicine bubble. But recently, I started to get emails. So I get, I assume anyone who has a hospital job does, I would get emails about shortages and lab tests that were down or up or changes or formulary and so on and so forth. And so I got an email a couple months ago in late summer, early fall or something like that, about how one of the vaccines was now no longer authorized and we needed to get the new one in and we didn't have any vaccines. And it's like, what is happening? I don't understand what's going on. Because again, I don't pay attention to stuff. This is not what I care about. I thought that was pretty weird. And then since I'm really busy with my actual job, I didn't get a chance to look into it. But then I forgot that this is the time of year, the fall is when patients start to ask you about, can you get vaccines while you're getting radiation? And I have always answered yes. But then they started specifically asking me about all these COVID vaccines. And I was like, I don't know anymore. And so I decided, because that's not a reasonable answer for a doctor, that I would try to go figure out where things are at. And it's still, pardon my French, a goddamn minefield. Like, what are you people doing? Are you serious? Like, I can't, when I went to go try to figure out where we're at right now, the end of 2023, 3 years into this, you all are still fighting about this stuff? Are you kidding me? And I am reminded of, people forget, people often like to talk about the military-industrial complex, and that's from Eisenhower's farewell speech. But there's a second half to that speech. So let's just kind of go in it and let's hear from the man himself.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic process. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together. Akin to and largely responsible for the sweeping changes in our industrial military posture has been the technological revolution during recent decades. In this revolution, research has become central. It also becomes more formalized, complex, and costly. A steadily increasing share is conducted for, by, or at the direction of the federal government. Today, the solitary inventor, tinkering in his shop, has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. In the same fashion, the free university, historically the fountainhead of free ideas and scientific discovery, has experienced a revolution in the conduct of research. Partly because of the huge costs involved, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. For every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. The prospect of domination of the nation's scars by federal employment, project allocation, and the power of money is ever present and is gravely, yet in holding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite.
So trying to cut through the noise here of what I am to make of any of this, because I can't evidently actually talk to people without triggering some sort of innate Pavlovian furor. There's a lot of unfortunate things that seem to be coming out about the vaccine, which is not surprising. You know, so again, this 95% thing, yeah, if you go back in and you look at the endpoints, all this is on the CDC website. Just go look it up for yourself. And then the long-term efficacy of, if you get the two vaccine sequence and the booster, you get, you know, drop into 50% at, was it a year? I don't even know. And then you get all this stuff about finding the vaccine or the mRNA in the myocardial tissue and the myocarditis stuff. And then you get all these whistleblowers about suppressing certain origin theories and all this stuff. And so what really got me, what really sort of pushed me over the edge into doing this was, despite my carefully crafted fortress around this topic, the thing about the DNA contaminants in the vaccine did break through into my bubble. And so what that is the Florida Surgeon General, and again, Florida, everyone knows my opinion of Florida, but, you know, had written a letter to the FDA about the findings of the DNA contaminants in the vaccine. And so the FDA didn't respond initially, and then they just responded, and basically saying that they think it's implausible that the DNA contaminants are going to cause an issue. And then if you go to like other websites, because I don't even know in what circles people talk about this, but you could find these debunking articles about, no, the vaccine doesn't cause cancer, the DNA contaminase doesn't cause cancer. So I read one of those. And it's saying that there are no reported cases of the DNA contaminants in the vaccine causing cancer, and it's proudly proclaimed debunked. No, that's not how this works. So first of all, the FDA is not saying, no, there aren't DNA contaminants in it. So there is a level that is allowed, as in, because you can't, you know, have zero. There's always safety. That's why there's like a blood alcohol level of 0.08 for, there's always some, right? So one, no one is denying that these DNA contaminants are in there and they exceed the threshold. Okay, we're all acknowledging that. Cool, great. That's a problem. That's a problem. Okay. So it's one thing if that whole thing is a hoax and made up, but no, it's there and it's a problem. Two, yeah, no kidding. There's no reported cases. So by the same logic, HPV, what is a P16 mediated cancer? You know, how long does that take to show up after HPV infection? 30, 40 years? So by this same logic, if you told me that the HPV virus, the infection with HPV, causes P16 cancer, I would tell you that is a hoax. That is fake news. And I have debunked it because there are no reported cases. HPV showed up a year or two ago, and I looked around and studied the entire nation. I would find no cases of HPV-mediated cancer. I would tell you that there is a, that is not acceptable. That is not acceptable. And again, we go back to, in every other aspect of our lives, we decry the crimes of big pharma. And then we freely talk about the quote unquote revolving door of the FDA and industry. And we have these conversations in parallel, like that Alzheimer's drug that the FDA approved earlier this year. Everyone is in up in arms about that. But we firewall this topic. And we just turn off critical thinking. And then, oh, the British Medical Journal just published this tantalizing article recently.
The physician scientist Doran Fink worked his way up at the Food and Drug Administration with a focus on the regulation of vaccines. Part of his role was to engage vaccine manufacturers to advise on the development of vaccines during the pandemic. In mid-2020, Fink announced the FDA's expectations for any COVID vaccine that the agency would consider authorizing, and he took a part in the ultimate decision to license the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. Fink's LinkedIn profile states that he finished his role at the FDA in December 2022. 2 months later, he was working at Moderna, heading the Translational Medicine and Early Clinical Development Program in Infectious Diseases. He is one of two regulators the BMJ has found to have recently moved to Moderna from the FDA's Office of Vaccines Research and Review. Similarly to Fink, Jaya Goswami started at the FDA in its Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research in March 2020. As a medical officer, she had, in her words, broad oversight over vaccines and biologics clinical development and was responsible for evaluating whether the clinical data for Moderna's COVID vaccine met regulatory standards for approval. Licensure was granted at the end of January 2022. Goswami's LinkedIn profile states that she left the FDA in June 2022 and that same month started a new role as Director of Clinical Development in Infectious Diseases at Moderna. A Phase 1 clinical trial commenced in March 2020, 66 days after the viral sequence was released, and by midsummer, the US had pledged $955 million towards a Phase 3 trial, with an additional $1.5 billion promised through an advance purchase agreement due on delivery of 100 million doses. By March 2021, a congressional report estimated that Moderna had $4.94 billion in federal funding for a total of 300 million doses. On December 18, 2020, under the leadership of FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn, the FDA granted a world first authorization to Moderna's COVID vaccine, mRNA-1273. 6 months later, after resigning his post with the transition to the Biden administration, Hahn joined the flagship Pioneering. the venture fund that birthed Moderna.
So you're telling me that the thing that has always happened happened again? Wow, I'm shocked. Who saw this one coming? Why is this any different? Why are we going into tribalism camps for this topic? You know, go read Monsanto, 1989. This is just how it goes. And here's the thing that kills me when you go try to see what people not in science and medicine talk about this. There's no conspiracy here in that. There's no greater force or behind the scenes force. Oh, again, I'm assuming there's not. I mean, I don't have perfect knowledge. So I'm assuming if there is the Illuminati, then wow, egg on my face. But this is called playing the game. So when we talk about networking, you know, I can see how this all played out, where there was no conspiracy. It's just, we don't need an organizing force. If you can get that far, like, you know, if you find like Stephen Hahn, who's one of us radiation medicine doctors, if you can get into the position that Hahn gets into, you play the game, okay? You know what you're doing. And you don't need to be told, you know, you need to do X, Y, Z, and then we'll pull it. You just know, okay? And so I think that the pandemic was an accident. And I think that the VC is just, they're prepared for these things. They took advantage, they saw an opportunity, and they took it because that's just what they do. And these people at the FDA, the revolving door, that's just what they do. The only thing that happened here was just opportunities presented themselves, and the people who were going to take advantage of opportunities took advantage of opportunities. And that's just how it is. And the rest of us still have to actually treat patients and be good doctors. And I'm just so sick of this. And it is, again, this is my New Year's resolution, because that's what this episode's about, is to, I got to stop ignoring these things. Like, it's so uncomfortable. I don't want to do this. And I'm so mad at the people who make me feel like this is off limits, or that I can't talk about this. And I know that I'm not alone here. And I think for my New Year's resolution, this excerpt from a recent article by Steven Pinker really says it best.
If we are to have any hope of advancing rational beliefs against the riptide of my side bias, primitive intuitions, and mythological thinking, we must safeguard the credibility of these institutions. Experts, such as public health officials, should be prepared to show their work rather than deliver pronouncements ex cathedra. Fallibility should be acknowledged. We all start out ignorant about everything, and whenever changing evidence calls for changing advice, that should be touted as a readiness to learn rather than stifled as a concession of weakness.
If we are to have any hope of advancing rational beliefs against the riptide of my side bias, that is a great line. And it's sort of the point of all this. And so here, if anyone wants to talk about the vaccine with me, and you have not made any public statements about any of this for the past 3 years, I'm all ears. And maybe we could just kind of be doctors together and scientists together. And that's my requisite, is I don't have a side here. There are no sides in this. I don't care. All right. I make a podcast about radiation. I don't have any sort of political affiliations because I don't care. Right. I got into this thinking that I would live in a world of merit and study objectively the nature of reality. And I would be with my colleagues who would do the same. And it's all a lie. And talking about paradigm shifts in this, the frame of 122 years. So if you look at discovery of X-rays, transformer models, and, you know, those of us who are early to mid-career, and there's a lot of us, and we've got a long road ahead. And pardon my French again, but we've kind of been handed a shit deal. And I'm looking around for the adults in the room, and they ain't it. They ain't here. And if you're like me and you've been ignoring these things, I think we got to stop, because it's clearly not working. And, you know, I think we need to do better for ourselves and our patients. And if these people who are here fighting about God even, I don't even know, because I don't even know what these people fight about. If they want to go do that, they can go do that. They can go spin their wheels. The rest of us will just, you know, do the doctor thing like adults. And I just, again, I think I'm going to only listen to President Eisenhower from here on out, certainly for at least 2024.
It is the task of statesmanship to move, to balance, and to integrate these and other forces, new and old, within the principles of our democratic system, ever aiming toward the supreme goals of our free society.
This has been a Photon Media production. Don't forget to like and subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen to us. Be well and beam on.